Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
What can you do when your friends get sick of you prying into their problems?
Do what everyone else is doing, of course. Start a podcast.
Introducing If I Speak, a brand new podcast from me, Ash Sarkar.
And me, Moya Lothian-McLean, where we pitch each other our big theories about the universe, share the intrusive thoughts keeping us up at night, and best of all, tackle your personal dilemmas.
We'll be asking questions like, does tabloid gossip turn us all into conspiracy theorists?
Should you financially support a parent?
Is Moya turning into a bit of a femcel?
Yes. What's Ash's most toxic trait?
Interrupting. From dating disorders to family feuds, career dilemmas to online etiquette.
The political gets personal on If I Speak.
Find us on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
It's gossip elevated.
Welcome to Intelligence Squared. I'm head of programming, Connor Boyle. On this episode, what is a life really worth, and can we put a price on it? Well, somewhat disturbingly, many organizations already do, from the insurance industry and the welfare sector to the murky underworld of organized crime. That question is the focus of journalist Jenny Kleeman's new book, The Price of Life. Joining Jenny to discuss it is Carl Miller, co-founder of the Center for the Analysis of Social Media at the think tank Demos. He's a fellow at the Global Initiative Against Transnational Organized Crime and author of The Death of the Gods, The New Global Power Grab. Here's Carl with more.
I'm delighted today to welcome back Jenny Kleeman, journalist, author and broadcaster. You've probably seen Jenny reporting for Channel 4's Foreign Affairs series, Unreported World, or maybe on BBC One's Panorama. But she is the author of Sex Robots, Vegan Meat, and her latest book also, which we're going to talk about today, The Price of Life, In Search of What We're Worth and Who Decides. Jenny, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
So I think you described it as the final frontier in monetization. What possessed you to go out and look at this kind of question of what we're all worth?
Well, it was a matter of timing, really. I'm not a numbers person. I'm not good with numbers. I'm a words person. And I did a story where I did the reporting for it in November 2019 about the world's richest philanthropists and how they're giving their money away according to these hyper-rational, effective altruist principles. And part of the way they do their philanthropy is to work out how to get the maximum bang for their buck, how to save the most lives per dollar. And that involves working out how much it costs to save a life and which lives are cheapest to save. And I did the reporting for this with a very arched eyebrow, thinking this is really grotesque that these people have worked out that the cheapest lives to save are kids in Africa, saving them from malaria or giving them deworming tablets. And quite a lot of the questions that they were asking themselves, like when is the worst time in a person's life for them to die? Is it worse if a newborn dies or if a 10-year-old dies? And it really jarred with me. But it turns out that these guys who I went to see were also looking at the dangers of malevolent AI and pandemics. And at the time, I thought, this is hilarious. They're looking at all of this. This is like kind of Bond villain stuff. But it turned out that they were on the money, really. And these were things that we needed to be looking at. So I started to think about the benefits of being able to put prices on lives, to perform really difficult calculations. And what do we lose and what do we gain of our humanity if we put prices on lives? And through doing the investigation for the book, I realised just how routine it is for prices to be put on lives very quietly all the time by actuaries and policymakers and judges and businesses. you know, a whole raft of people putting prices on our lives that we don't know about, but it's how so many decisions are made today.
And you looked at hitmen and murders and ransom demands, and hopefully we're going to deal with all of that, Jenny, but I wanted to begin with the sexiest topic of all, life insurance. Tell us a bit about life that industry and how that makes a valuation.
Do you know what? I discovered that insurance is in fact fascinating, Carl. This was not something that I expected to discover, but it is really, really interesting. So there is a chapter about life insurance where I look at people who fake their own death and how they do it and why they get the payouts that they get. And it's in fact quite common for people to try and fake their own death. It's not that common for them to get away with it. I spoke to someone whose dad faked his own death, and he was involved in the kind of cover up for that. And I spoke to a man whose job it is to hunt down people who are putatively dead, because people, whenever they fake their own death, they tend to do it in foreign countries. It's a death because obviously there's no body. And so they either die at sea or they die abroad. And so I interviewed a man who goes and investigates these insurance claims and goes abroad looking for people who are dead and sometimes discovering them very much alive. But I learnt a lot about life insurance because I was quite amazed that people who have no money can insure themselves for millions of pounds in order to try and to get that money when they fake their own deaths. And I learned that basically there's kind of two sides to life insurance. There's the price put on your life, which you decide. So the insurance company does not decide what your life is worth. You have to come up with that number yourself. All the insurance company cares about is how likely you are to die. So when you're filling in those forms to get life insurance, I had been doing it quite recently, actually, renewing some life insurance. And I had always thought it's because they were checking that I was in good health before they gave me a policy. But no, it's because there are algorithms and clever actuaries who are working out how likely you are to die before the end of the term. And so as long as you can afford the premiums for the value of your life that you have set, they don't care how much you think your life is worth. So long as you can pay the premiums, all they care about is how likely are they to pay. So you can basically insure, you can have multiple life insurance policies. Your life is the only thing that you can insure several times. You can insure your life as many times as you want for as much as you want. All the insurance company cares about is, are they going to have to pay? Are you going to die?
And was that one of the more kind of, I suppose, like rational areas where valuations are made? Were there other areas you found where the valuations seemed to be kind of less based on kind of evidence and models and data?
Yes. I mean, obviously there are some cases where the price put on your life isn't a real price. It's a kind of token that allows like for like comparisons. And so I found out that the Home Office every few years and quietly puts prices on crimes, the social and economic costs of crimes and how much a particular crime costs society, essentially. And they are at pains to say that the numbers that they've come up with, they're not necessarily real numbers, although actually when you look at their calculations, they are based on some very real numbers. But they're allowing for comparison, so you can say, you know, a murder costs society more than arson or this particular kind of cybercrime. And so they're a way of focusing resources. The NHS uses this figure of a quality adjusted life year, how much they're prepared to pay for each quality adjusted life year, £20,000 to £30,000 per quality adjusted life year it will add to a person's life. And that is just a token, and that's how you can compare different drugs for different conditions. But the problem is that these tokens, they do tend to take on a different kind of meaning when they're used all the time, and the people who use them all the time start to take them as a fact, really. And some prices just completely depend on market forces. I mean, the price of a hitman, which is surprisingly affordable, I was quite frightened to discover. That depends on the desperation of the person doing the hit, how much they need the money to kill someone. It's got nothing to do with the value of the mark of the person that they kill.
Well, I'm not sure any listener is going to forgive me if I move any further without asking you how much does it cost to take out a hit on someone.
To hire a hitman. The average British hitman costs around £15,000,
according
to the academics that I spoke to. So, you know, as the criminologist I spoke to said, it's the second-hand family car essentially, within a lot of people's pockets.
That's astonishingly affordable. I mean, I hope no one listening to this also gets any ideas, but I mean, what what are the market forces that come together there to make that valuation so low?
Well, there are different kinds of hitmen. We have this romanticized ideal of someone who arrives unnoticed with a gun with a silencer on and you know, does the job and then leaves and nobody notices them. And those people are very, very rare. And also we don't know very much about them because they don't get caught. And so we only really know about the ones who fail. But most hits are commissioned by people who are having business problems or have problems in their relationship and want a business associate or a partner taken out. And they tend to just ask people they know, people in the pub or people within minor criminal networks, people who know each other from prison, who spent time together. And, you know, some people have killed people for as little as £200 in the UK. But, you know, you can easily, if you know the right people, you can find somebody who has a £5,000 debt they need written off who will do this for you.
Hmm. Well, I know one of the places you found one of the more eye-watering valuations, Jenny, was the F-35 yes. base. Tell yes. us a bit about that.
I went to the Lockheed Martin factory in Fort Worth in Texas to see where the world's most expensive weapon is made, which is the F-35 fighter jet that we have just spent ridiculous amounts of money on in the UK. I think the program costs something like $400 billion, the American program, but each jet costs around between $100 and $150 million. And we've got 35 of them in the UK. We've spent an enormous amount of money on these jets. And I was very lucky to get access to this factory, which is one of the most staggeringly enormous things that I've ever seen. But I am not a petrol head, not that into planes, not even really that into cars. And so I wasn't that impressed by what I was seeing. But the thing is, the planes themselves are not meant to look impressive. They're meant to be stealthy. You can't really see them because they are, you know, radar can't track them down. They're meant to be able to perform all this wizardry, being able to do vertical takeoff like a helicopter. But they didn't demonstrate any of that for me. And for me, it just looked like a plane. I couldn't really understand why it was so expensive. And they also wouldn't tell me in the factory how much each plane cost. I kept asking them. They had lots and lots of figures of how many jobs the program created and how many hours it took to make each plane, but they would not tell me how much each plane cost. And I eventually found that out through speaking to people from the MOD here in the UK. But it was a kind of adventure in the amount of money the Ministry of Defence is prepared to spend in order to create jobs and to sustain the industry of the defense network, you know, which we're all kind of, it looked to me like this was a project that was too big to fail because we had sunk so much money into it already that we were continuing with it, even though it didn't seem obvious to me how these planes were actually going to be useful in a world where climate change is perhaps one of the biggest threats that we face, and these planes, you know, guzzle aviation fuel.
And as you visit all these places, Jenny, I'm just interested, how did you kind of navigate this kind of moral question, I think, you set up for yourself, you know, whether these worlds were kind of coldly dehumanizing or actually rational exercises in the allocation of scarce resources? I mean, for somewhere, like the NHS, it's hard to imagine how you can get away from having to make these kinds of decisions around resources and money ultimately and lives saved and years retained.
Yes, and you kind of need people that have a slightly different brain to my brain, who are able to detach themselves and make these calculations. In a world of finite resources, you have to make these choices. But what was interesting for me when I was, for example, looking at how NICE decides which drugs to fund and who gets them, to discover that even in a situation where there's supposed to be, you know, standards and protocols across the board, there is still leeway, that certain people can get the drugs if they campaign enough, if they go on the news and say, it's not fair, babies under the age of 6 months get this drug that will save their life, but my baby's 6.5 months and he's not getting it. you know, that there is always leeway, that there is always a kind of human element of judgment in all of this. And that's a good thing, really. We can't allow ourselves to be ruled by these numbers. And, you know, the very process of putting prices on lives requires you to be able to remove the humanity from them. And I don't think that's an exercise that we should get very good at as a society, being really good at taking our humanity out of things.
Well, and let's then go to effective altruism, which is, of course, a movement that has shot into the spotlight for many reasons recently, if not least of which its association with Sam Bankman-Fried and FTX and the world of crypto. So what did you find there? Did you find refreshingly data-driven approach to the giving of money, or did you find something else?
I found some people, the people who I met. So I met with the people who run Dustin Moskovitz's foundation. Dustin Moskovitz he's like number two in Facebook. He shared a dorm with Mark Zuckerberg in Harvard, and he's giving away $11 billion of his fortune before he dies. And I found the people who I spoke to there, I believed them. They really do want to do good. And they seem to genuinely want to make the greatest impact in the world. But there is a lot of the people who are involved in this movement have this kind of computer scientist, elite university background. And they kind of believe that they are better equipped to solve the world's problems because they're engineering geniuses than governments or charities. And there is a concern for me that a lot of companies, like, for example, you know, Jeff Bezos gives a lot of his money away. And yet a lot of his wealth comes from Amazon's incredible ability to avoid paying tax. You know, these billionaires are not accountable. And they're not accountable to voters. And so they're kind of shaping the world through their philanthropic giving according to what they think is the best way to solve problems. And they're immensely powerful. So I think the people that I met, I think, are determined to do good. But I met a lot of them in San Francisco and in the Bay Area, where there is such manifest desperation on the streets. You are literally walking over homeless people in crisis to get to the offices to interview these people. And effective altruism, you know, requires that you do not pay any attention to the homeless person on your doorstep and instead funnel your money where it's going to go furthest, which are the starving children in Africa. And I felt like there was something disturbing about requiring people to think that way and tune out of their daily environment in that way.
Intelligence Squared is a tight-knit team doing big things, and it means we're always looking for tools that can help streamline managing tasks. That's why I want to talk to you for a minute about NetSuite. NetSuite provides cloud-based software to get things moving. Maybe your business has been humming, but you can feel things are falling behind a little bit. Or perhaps your team is getting snowed with manual tasks and closing those books is taking forever. If this sounds like you, you should know these three numbers. 37,000, 25, 1. 37,000, that's the number of businesses which have upgraded to NetSuite by Oracle. 25, NetSuite turns 25 this year. That's 25 years of helping businesses do more with less, allowing them to close their books in days, not weeks, and drive down costs. And one, because your business is one of a kind, so you get a customized solution for all of your KPIs in one efficient system with one source of truth. It means you can manage risk, get reliable forecasts, and improve margins. It's everything you need to grow all in one place. NetSuite is now making an unprecedented offer to make more of that kind of thing possible. Right now, you can download NetSuite's popular KPI checklist designed to give you consistently excellent performance absolutely free at netsuite.com/squared. That's netsuite.com/squared to get your own KPI checklist. netsuite.com/squared. Sponsoring the show for this episode is Marquee TV. Marquee TV is a streaming service with a difference. It's bringing you the top tier of performing arts straight into your living room or onto your device. So think dance, theatre, music, anything you might find in the West End, Broadway, or maybe a cool little experimental space too, but saving you the cost of a few tickets as well. I've got happily a bit lost in their vast library of performances, exclusive interviews, and behind-the-scenes content. Choreographer Jonathan Watkins' interpretation of George Orwell's classic 1984 was pretty cool, and I love the dance piece, Sutra, inspired by the skills of Buddhist Shaolin monks. And we've got a special treat for our listeners. Marquee TV offers 3 months of access for just 99 cents. That's right, 3 months for only 99 cents. With the code SQUARED, simply visit marquee.tv and use the promo code SQUARED to dive into the world of arts like never before. Bring the arts home with Marquee TV. We make a lot of stuff here at Intelligence Squared. So many great chats to enrich the mind like the one you're listening to now. But like any business, it's really essential to be in good shape and keep things efficient so you can see the big picture all in one place. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform and one source of truth. With NetSuite, you can cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems, and it's super easy to get started because NetSuite exists in the cloud, so no hardware needed, cutting your IT costs too. And you'll also improve efficiency by bringing all your major processes into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. That's why over 37,000 companies have already made the move. The cost of living crisis might not be making anything any cheaper, but there's real value in feeling on top of things, which is something I experience firsthand as an event producer every day. And now, by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/squared. That's netsuite.com/squared. netsuite.com/squared.
You must be one of the only people around, Jenny, that can kind of make all these links between life insurance and an F-35 base and NICE and the NHS and effective altruism. Did you find yourself beginning to kind of make these kind of comparisons between these different valuation communities and contexts?
I did. And I also found myself, as I went through doing the reporting for the book, becoming quite cavalier about it and being quite like, oh yes, of course, you know, it's much, because when I was looking at the cost of the pandemic, I was like, of course, it's much harder to calculate the harm done to young people through lockdown versus, you know, the number of lives saved through lockdown, you know. And I, things that at the beginning of reporting, I felt really shocked by, like, oh my God, these people are prepared to ask, when is the worst age for a child to die? And towards the end, I was kind of taking it in my stride a little bit, having spent so much time with all these different people who do it. But that's because I saw, you know, the benefits and the drawbacks of looking at the world through this lens. It can reveal incredible injustices and it can show you what we need to do to improve. I had to be quite nimble, but towards the end, I was quite blasé about it all.
What do you think is the most consequential act of valuation for people listening to this? So is there one particular world that you think people need to pay more attention to or need to think more about?
There are so many. I mean, it's hard for me to know where to begin. Certainly the thing that I uncovered that shocked me the most was how unfair criminal injury compensation is, that if you are killed in a terrorist attack, the amount that your family will get in compensation varies by an enormous order of magnitude according to what country you're a citizen of, and also how you're killed. That if you're hit by a van, your family might get £1.5 million. If you're stabbed by a knife, in the UK, your family will get £11,000. This is incredibly unfair. But then there are kind of even more, there are things that we are going to face every day in everyday life that really shocked me, or at least that we'll all know somebody who faces. I was quite shocked by the cost of fertility treatment and by the fact that even in the UK, the majority of people having fertility treatment end up paying for it. And there is an exploding fertility industry that is doing whatever they can to expand the services that they offer, and at a time when fertility rates are declining. And I can really see ourselves sleepwalking into a world where the only people who have children are the biologically fortunate and the wealthy who can afford all this treatment. And that would really disturb me, really.
Well, I feel myself being drawn in to this whole world as well now, where all I want is the numbers. So how much does it cost? What's the average cost of fertility treatment? How does that compare to these other worlds, these other valuations?
Well, I mean, that's the thing. What was so interesting for me was the amount of stuff that lingers around the £15,000 mark. So About £13,500 is what the average person in the UK, heterosexual couple, spends on fertility treatment. If you're gay, if you're a gay man, you will spend $200,000 on average if you want to pursue biological parenthood. But some people spend £50,000, £60,000, £70,000, heterosexual couples, trying to conceive a child. And I spoke to people who'd, you know, undergone incredible financial hardship simply because they really wanted to have their own children. But yeah, a surprising number of things linger around the £13,000, £14,000, £15,000 mark when it comes to pricing up lives.
I know. I immediately thought, oh, just under the cost of a probably failed, not very good hitman.
Yes. Well, yes. I mean, this is a thing that it costs around the same to create a life as it does to remove it from the earth. But then, you know, there's also at either end of the scale, the cheapest and the most expensive lives. There's kind of horror at either side of the scale there. I looked at the cost of buying a slave. You can get a slave in Libyan markets for as little as $400. And you can buy a cadaver, a dead human body, to do anatomical dissection of, or to engineer medical devices, that costs about $5,000. So it's really shocking to discover that, you know, that the dead bodies of slaves being sold in Libya are worth 10 times as much as their living bodies. Really shocking.
Gosh. And how do you learn all of these things, Jenny? I commend everyone to read the book, because it what shines through so clearly is how important you think it is to actually go to the places and meet the people that can show you these worlds. How would you go about that? How would you identify the world, and how would you kind of begin to dig under the skin of each of these different places and communities?
My background's in documentary making, so I'm always thinking in terms of scenes. Where could I go and what could I see happening in real time, hopefully? So I'm always thinking in terms of that. And even when I do interviews, I don't really want to do them over Zoom or, across a desk. No, you know, for something like this, it's fine. And this is the really interesting thing, is post-pandemic, interviewees don't understand why you would want to travel halfway around the world sometimes to interview them. And it's because, you know, you need to be in their space and in their environment and getting a sense of who they are and how they work from that. It's much harder now to make that case. So I'm always thinking in terms of scenarios and where can I go that is dynamic, that will illustrate the point that I'm trying to make through scenes and action, rather than just necessarily the words. And even things like, you know, there is a chapter where I speak to a couple who had to negotiate for the ransom of the man's sister. And even just being in their house, in their farmhouse, I got such a sense of who they are and what the stakes were for them by being in their space that I would have just never got from, you know, reading a book about their scenario, or even from talking to them on Zoom.
How would you say these worlds are changing? So this is a world now, of course, awash with data, with models.
Yeah.
I haven't even mentioned the word artificial intelligence yet, but of course, like, you know, we would be complete. We can't ignore that. So do you think that these different, I don't know how you view them, valuation communities or practices, are they all also going to be reformed in the years ahead?
I think so. I think the numbers that are tokens, the prices that are put on our lives as tokens, are going to be less tokens. They're going to be become a more accurate representation of what the NHS believes you to be worth, or what the Home Office thinks your life is worth saving. You know, when you look at life insurance, for example, the one thing that they don't enter into the mix when they're deciding how likely it is that you are to die, going to die, is they don't use your genes, your genetic code, to look at your propensity to get certain diseases and conditions. And every year, the Association of British Insurers has a kind of meeting with the government, and they decide whether or not they're going to keep that moratorium. But I can imagine a future where, in exchange for cheaper premiums or more accurate life insurance cover, you would spit into a vial, give it to your insurer, instead of, or as well as filling in those very, very long forms. You know, we are living in a world in love with data where data is more valuable than oil, so they say. And as such, I think these numbers are going to become more and more accurate, more and more the product of computers, more and more of a science rather than an art. And that's why we need to talk about them and how they're being used all the time, because at the moment, the people who use these numbers and rely on them generally don't want to talk about them.
And that's that very nicely, I think, brings us on to those very people. So the kind of valuers, if we are the valued. Tell us a bit about those people, Jenny. Like, kind of how do they get to decide, like, what lives are worth?
Well, sometimes it's because, you know, in the case of actuaries, although that, yes, they don't really decide what lives are worth, they decide whether or not to insure you for what you think the life is worth. They're highly skilled people. Sometimes they are economists who are just very good at being dispassionate. Sometimes they are people with a background in business who are just looking at the market price for things. But ultimately, you know, this goes on whenever there is any decision not to do something life-saving, like, you know, smart motorways or childproof caps on bottles or lifeboats on the Titanic. As soon as people say, oh no, that's too expensive, we're not going to do that, they have put a price on life. So they have effectively said the amount of money that they are prepared to spend to save a life and where that limit is. And you do have to have limits in a world of finite resources. So a lot of people who are putting prices on lives wouldn't necessarily recognise that that's what they're doing. They just are doing it through the little decisions that they make every day.
But is this something that we should stand in the way in or not? Because, you know, there's part of me that thinks, actually, you know, this is just good old-fashioned consequentialism. This is Bentham and Mill. Philosophers have long been arguing that basically we need to just weigh up and sum up utility, and actually everything that's happening now with models and AI, well, it's just the most perfect expression of that. But now, on the other side, as you say, there's something quite horrifying about the reduction of human beings to these numbers and the elimination of the immeasurable from these kinds of calculations.
I think in a consequentialist way, this can be useful as a tool for revealing injustice. It can show you if you are valuing somebody's life as much greater, as being worth much more than somebody else's. It can show you if you're saying the life of a French person killed by a car in the London Bridge attacks is worth many, many, many tens of times more than the life of a British person stabbed by a knife. This is not fair. This is something that should be remedied. But it's a tool. It is not a fact of life. And my concern, particularly hanging out with the effective altruists who are so into their numbers, is that they, whilst they know that they're using these numbers as a tool, they can kind of be blinded by them and led by them. And, you know, we need to be aware, I think, more generally about when we are switching off our ability to feel compassion and humanity for those around us. So we need to, I mean, for example, I thought in the pandemic, it was very interesting that the government spent six times as much saving our lives from COVID as it would as the NHS would from any other disease. This is a fact of them. And that's because Rishi Sunak was saying constantly, we will do whatever it takes. We will do whatever it takes. But whatever it takes does have a bill at the end of it. And it turned out we spent so much money saving people's lives from COVID through the measures, the lockdown measures, and what they cost society compared to anything else. And that's not necessarily that's not necessarily what people would have wanted at the time, but that is how it was. So anyway, you know, to sum all of that up, the price of life is very useful so long as we remember that it is a tool to get us towards fairness. We need to have other things in our toolkit as well. It is not the answer. It's an answer that we should be aware of. It is an indicator, but it doesn't tell us the true value of anyone.
Well, my last question, Jenny, is an extremely selfish one. How can I, or indeed anyone listening to you now, how do we become more proactive in this whole world? Are there ways that we can increase our own valuations? You know, is there any way that we can get a bit of agency?
Well, I have to say, Carl, unfortunately, women are worth a lot more than men because our bodies are worth more as surrogates. Our eggs and perhaps our long hair means that our body parts are worth more. But no, I mean, you don't necessarily want to be worth a lot of money. There is incredible suffering and pain for those whose lives are valued at the greatest and at the least who are the slaves, the greatest who are those whose lives have been taken by an F-35 or people who've been murdered. You don't want to have a high price put on your life because if you do, you're likely to be kidnapped, for example. So I would say anybody listening to this, watching this, that you should just aim to stick in the middle ground, even though that might mean that it's quite affordable for someone to hire a hitman to take you out.
All right. Well, you've heard Jenny, everyone. Let's keep our valuations nice and capped. Sitting there in the middle ground. Well, Jenny, thank you so much. Thank you for a wonderful conversation. The book again is called The Price of Life, In Search of What We're Worth and Who Decides. I've been Carl Miller, and you've been listening to Intelligence Squared.
This episode was produced by Leila Ishmael and edited by Tom Hall. If you want to keep up with everything going on at Intelligence Squared, sign up to the newsletter. Head over to intelligencesquared.com to get the heads up on all our live events coming up, including in-person talks with the likes of Armando Iannucci talking satire in Dark Times, Jonathan Haidt on how the internet is affecting our mental health and how to fix Gen Z, and an evening with the author and journalist Yomi Adegoke. That's all over at intelligencesquared.com.